Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Wake Up to Purpose with your host, John Stanko. This program will help you find your purpose and, more importantly, how to make your purpose work for you. And now, here's John Stanko.
Well, hello out there in internet land. This is John Stanko, your host, as the announcer said, and I don't know why I feel the need to bolster that or reinforce that, but it seems like I always do, and I hope you don't mind. It's been a week since we have been together, and I was just reflecting over almost 7 months now of from when I came home from Florida on March the 13th, and I think I've been sitting at my desk ever since. And so one of the things I did in April was start up Blog Radio again, which I used to do for my church, and I used to do for Geneva College, and I used to do for the Center for Urban Biblical Ministry, and now I'm doing for my own ministry, Purpose Quest International, and reflecting on, I think this is about show number 80. And one of the things that, one of the benefits of the show is it's helped me connect and stay connected with people I really wish I could be more connected to, but time and work and ministry tends to take us in our own separate directions. One of those is our guest today, Reverend Dr. Richard Wingfield, my colleague in professorship and a colleague, a fellow man of the cloth and friend is waiting in the wings, and we'll be bringing him on in just a minute, and have a chance to talk to him. You know, an hour is not going to be long, because when we get into current events, when we get into ministry, when we get into teaching, and then I see he's back in school. This is so exciting. And so, again, my point is that I get to stay connected with people of interest, people who matter to me. That has been a bonus of this show, in addition to it going now to listeners. Maybe they've only listened to one or two episodes, but it represents more than 40 nations and thousands of listeners. So it's been really fun. You know, I took some time off in August and just determined I was doing it 5 days a week, and that I kept that going for about 5 months, and then people, you know, were getting busy, getting back into some semblance of their own routine. So, you know, I was ready to put it aside, but I felt that the Lord say, do it as your guests are available. And I've got, this is the first show this week, but I've got three shows lined up for next week. Anyway, why am I going into all that? There is absolutely no good reason, because in a minute we're going to get to our guest, but also I just did a Facebook Live presentation, and one of the things I didn't mention was the class that I'm involved with. I think I have alluded to teaching now for Ottawa University in Kansas, and Ottawa was founded by American Baptists in 1865 as an educational outreach to the Ottawa tribe. And the Ottawa tribe is still a part of the university. The tribal chief, the head of the Ottawa Nation, is on the board of directors. And if he recommends any Ottawa tribe student, then they get a free ride at Ottawa University, even this 155 years later. And free ride, everything, room and board, books, tuition, everything. And so So when I first got involved, I asked the president, well, you know, I didn't think, how many students would this be? And he said there were about 40 at the Ottawa, Kansas campus, and about 40 in the Arizona campus. So I thought, how cool is that? They also have on campus an Eternal flame or a perpetual flame to commemorate the many wrongs that were perpetrated against not just the Ottawa Native Americans, but many others. And so every time I walk into the library there, when I was on campus, every time I would walk into the student union where I would take my meals, I would see that flame and be reminded of the ongoing work of reconciliation that, of course, we with a Christian worldview believe is only possible in its fullness and totality as God would have wanted it to be through the church. And I've often said if the church can barely get it together with the truth that we have as far as people coming together, I don't know how much hope there is for anybody else in society. At any rate, I'm teaching this Gospels class, and I have 48 students, and the final exam I assigned is a 12-page paper. So it was due at midnight last night. I think I have 42 of the 48 students have submitted. So guess what I'll be doing this weekend, and why this weekend? Because a new cohort, they do 8-week terms, a new cohort started last Monday, and their first assignment will be submitted to me Monday morning. So I got to get these papers done so I can get started with the next 8 weeks. At any rate, enough about all that. Let me bring on a man that I believe is one of the best manuscript preachers, as I said in my introduction on Facebook, that I've ever been around. Also, a highly regarded professor and instructor. All my years of teaching with Geneva College, I never heard a student complain about Dr. Richard Wingfield, so let me bring him on right now. Reverend Wingfield, welcome to Wake Up to Purpose.
Thank you, John. It's good to be on this blog talk radio, and I'm honored to have even been asked to be here.
Oh, gosh. Well, the honor is ours, and it really is going to be good to connect with you. Now, I was reading through your bio, and you are an adjunct faculty at Duquesne University, my alumna, my alma mater. Is this correct?
That is correct. I'm adjunct there and working on the PhD in communication and rhetoric.
How exciting. Yeah, and what are you teaching at Duquesne?
Currently, I'm teaching public speaking.
In fact, I
just finished a midterm this week with the students, and so this has been an exciting almost year and a half now that I've been a part of the Duquesne family.
Yeah. What? And of course, you've taught for many years for Geneva College and in other settings. What makes it so exciting? What is the newness of it, the topic you're teaching, the student body, all of it? Talk to us about what makes it such an exhilarating opportunity for you now.
Well, for one thing, teaching. I've always loved teaching. I've enjoyed teaching down through the years. I consider it exciting because it has really stretched me into areas that I have not normally been engaged in. And so that is exciting to be a part of the PhD program itself. Has been very exciting to really sit down and listen to key professors in the field that I am in, and to bounce ideas, bounce thoughts off of colleagues of mine has been very interesting and rewarding for me.
Yeah, it's really so fascinating. You know, until I got your bio, I had no idea. And of course, I tout you as a great communicator. And I think of Esther, you know, who when she won the beauty contest, God sent her to school for another year to be even more beautiful. And here we are, a great communicator, that God is sending back to school to become even a better communicator, not just through classes, but through teaching classes. And so you're doing it both through study and through application. And I just that is certainly exciting. And Duquesne University's great gain. And I'm just delighted to hear that. How long do you have for your own PhD? How long will it take?
Well, I've done approximately a year and a half of classes now. I still have another year and a half of coursework to complete, and then the comprehensive exam to complete, and then the dissertation.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I would imagine another 3 years or so.
Wow. Wow. Well, congratulations to you. You know, that's quite exciting. And I think Geneva's current president, Dr. Traub, was over that doctoral rhetoric program. Am I correct in that at one time?
He was a part of that program. Yes, he was. He was
mm-hmm.
a part of that program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In
when
fact,
I did
he,
my
he
team
did
in
a,
it. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
He did a piece on, I think, St. Augustine that I really want to really wanted to get into and read. So
mm-hmm.
I'm looking forward
yeah.
to that.
Yeah, he was in, they brought him in for the D-Min at Reformed, and I had him for communication. It was outstanding, and we worked hard. But he was in the program at that time, and we could end the broadcast right now, and I would be well satisfied because of what I've already found out. But I'm holding in my hand a book called All in the Family, 75 Years of Wingfield Preaching. And let me read off the back cover. The Wingfield family business has been the ministry, and this book contains preach messages from four Wingfield pastors who serve churches in the western Pennsylvania area. Talk to us, you know, maybe about the book, but then I know that will probably expand into a discussion of your family in ministry, your own call. So just talk to us a little bit about All in the Family, 75 Years of Wingfield Preaching.
The book itself was an outgrowth of an independent study I did when I was working on the Master Divinity degree at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. I've been blessed, John, with volumes, if you will, of sermons that go back some 70 years.
Mm-hmm.
Preaching has been in my family on the Wingfield side, and I'm going to qualify that in just a minute. But my grandfather, W.W. Wingfield Sr., served as a pastor a little church in Princeton, West Virginia, and moved the family here to Western Pennsylvania. Subsequently became the pastor of First Baptist Church in Findlayville, Pennsylvania. And then after a period of time, I believe about 7 years, I was called to the Trinity Baptist Church in the Lawrenceville section of Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
My uncle and my father were pastors as well. My uncle had been pastoring longer, of course, but my father received the call to ministry the year that my grandfather passed. My grandfather passed of a massive heart attack outside St. Francis Hospital back in 1964, and that year my father received a call to the ministry, and I vaguely remember him preaching and his text for his initial sermon was Isaiah chapter 6, verse 1. In the year King Uzziah died, I saw also the Lord.
Hmm.
And so I have those collection of sermons down through the years since about the 1950s. Possibly earlier. I have some handwritten manuscripts that possibly went back earlier than the 1950s. but also kind of pulled in my sermons. And what I did was develop a volume of sermons that included my grandfather, my uncle, my father, and myself. And I put them in that order to acknowledge the length of time in the ministry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I said I was going to qualify that, John, in the fact that that is my father's side. On my mother's side, the Williams family, I am fourth generation pastor. My great-grandfather was a pastor in the Richmond, Virginia area, as well as in Charleston, West Virginia. His son, H.R. Williams Jr., pastored in a little town called Mount Hope, West Virginia, where my mother was born, and subsequently received the call to pastor the Mount Olive Baptist Church in Rankin, PA, right outside of Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
He has had two sons. One went home to be with the Lord about 3 or 4 years ago. Well, 2 or 3 years ago now. He was living in Atlanta, Georgia, but he had at one time pastored a Lutheran church as well as a Free Methodist church. And then I had another uncle who is in Cincinnati, Ohio, who I believe is an AME associate minister. And so I have a cousin who pastors in Philadelphia. And so, you know, it's on both sides of the family. It's really on both sides of the family. I've not pulled together any sermons from that side of the family. I just had access to the Wingfield side, which was the reason why I pulled that volume together.
Yeah. Gee, with all that, I'm not sure you were called. You may have just have been cornered. I think you just didn't have much choice. You really had to. When we worked on the book, I loved the book of sermons. I learned a lot. I mean, it was biblically really, really sound content and gave me new insights into passages that were preached. But the thing we saw was that these messages were all messages of the times. If that's correct, talk to us about what you saw, what that meant, and you know, how a pastor or a preacher never preaches in a vacuum. They're always immersed in the midst of the culture in which they are worshiping and preaching.
I forgot who it was now off the top of my head, but there was a theologian who said that whenever you preach, you should have the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other. Nowadays, it's the Bible in one hand and the internet on your computer screen. The sermons that were, in particular, the sermons that were selected were contextual sermons of the times. And so you have to go back to prior to and the beginning stages of the civil rights movement to really kind of understand the context out of which some of those sermons were preached, as well as during the time of progress within African Americans following, you know, the death of Martin King and the affirmative action and some of the things that took place as a result of the civil rights era. I would say of the three, and I'm not including myself in this, but of the three, my grandfather, my father, and my uncle, my father was more social conscience in his preaching than my grandfather and my uncle. I think part of that may have been because I was around my father more than anyone else, and so I heard more of his sermons. Mm-hmm. But even knowing who my father hung around, who were his closest friends, they were as well social conscious preachers. And so your context always impacts the development of your sermon. So I've noticed that just in the study. I just noticed that in the study, reading through many of the sermons. And I've not read through all of them, to be honest with you, John. I haven't really even scratched the surface of some of the sermons that I have. So.
Yeah, yeah. So now, you said you left yourself out. Would you say now that you are, and it was Karl Barth who said,
right,
Bible in one hand, yeah. Are you following in their footsteps of being socially aware, and how is that impacting your preaching, and be as specific as you want to be?
Yes, I have followed in their footsteps. I'll be honest with you. I have, when my father passed, he handed down, my mother gave me several of his books from his library. And those books included some of the works of black theologians of that time. You're talking those, for example, of a Gardner C. Taylor or a William Augustus Jones. I got my hands on one of the first works by James Cone, who just recently passed, as well as and just getting my hands on those volumes and reading through those volumes, it put me in contact with other black liberation theologians, such as a Gayrod Wilmore. There's another one who's on my mind now, and I can't call his name. C. Eric Lincoln, James Evans. It put me in contact with many more. Dwight Hopkins now. And then my seminary days really helped to expose me to more of a black liberation theology thought, if you will, with sitting under the teaching of Ron Peters, who I consider a mentor and a very dear friend. And so just exposure like that really helped to shape my preaching, so that when I preach, and I'm not saying I do this every Sunday, but some of my preaching does deal with some social issues that we're dealing with in this day and age.
How have you handled preaching and teaching in church during the pandemic?
This has been a very, very interesting trek over the last, 7 months now. For the most part, I did a lot of the preaching from my study where I am now at home. It is only recently, and when I say recently, I'd say within the last 3 weeks, that we have actually returned to the sanctuary, and there's only a handful of us who are in the sanctuary preaching. But I will state this, that preaching to an empty sanctuary and preaching right in your study when there's no one around to say amen or what have you is a totally different animal. You are well aware of the fact that, in particular within the black tradition, you know, we have the call response. We're used to the congregation talking back to us in our preaching. Well, when you don't have that, That challenges your preaching to be more pointed. And it reminds us, and one of the things I really have taught my associate ministers, and you know that you and I shared together around a class on preaching. But one of the things that I've taught them or continue to teach them is the fact that you do not preach for response. You preach for results. So that even if folk don't say amen, you are not influenced by whether or not people respond to you, because you're really preaching for results, and you are honing your message, your sermon, in such a way that you have content in your sermon, which I think is very, very critical. I actually did something, John, during this pandemic situation that I had been wanting to do for a while and have not done, and that is I actually, during this pandemic, preached through the book of James, verse by verse, and which I felt was very helpful to the congregation. I titled it Practical Christianity in an Impractical Age, and really honing in on how even in the midst of this pandemic, we can live out our Christianity.
Yeah, and but it was quite an adjustment and a big transition to do it in the way you were doing it.
Yes, it was a huge transition. The last time the church actually gathered together on a Sunday morning in mass was the third Sunday in March. And ironically, to show you how this pandemic has impacted our congregation, we do an annual fellowship with a church in New Jersey, Passaic, New Jersey. And we were up there, as usual, on the second Sunday in March, visiting with our friends there and doing a worship service with them there. The second Sunday in April was Easter Sunday. About 2 weeks after we were up there, got word that our pastor friend there, Dr. W. Lewis McDowell, was in the hospital. He was hospitalized and found out on Easter Sunday that he had gone home to be with the Lord 1 month after we were up there, and that he succumbed to COVID-19 virus. And so that really impacted the congregation, because we had been doing this. Some people have been doing this for some 35 years, this travel back and forth and what have you. So it really impacted people within our congregation. And then to discover that three or four of our members within our own congregation had contracted this virus. And so it caused us to really be very careful about how we assemble. Again, we have not assembled in mass since the third Sunday in March. I have now just a few people, maybe about 10 now, in the sanctuary on Sunday morning, since we are streaming our services now from the sanctuary. We'll have a praise team, a couple of musicians, myself, my wife, and a couple other members there in the congregation who are helping out with the streaming and with the audio piece of it and what have you. And that's it. That's it. We're trying to give a churchy feeling to those who are watching as well as those who are listening. I know, and I'll go here for a moment, they say that a necessity is the mother of invention. And so this pandemic pushed a lot of churches, including ours, into a new realm of ministry that some people had been reluctant to do, and that is doing the streaming of our services and what have you. And so one of my members was so excited over the fact that she finally learned how to use conference call, which shows you know, how, you know, we have an older congregation, so it really shows you how this thing is really stretching people into new mm-hmm. realms of technology.
Yeah. Yeah. Is your program at Duquesne, does it cover at all any, I don't want to say aspects of technology, but usage of technology, or do you see that, you know, coming down the road in some of your future classes? Is that an issue at all?
One of the classes that I'm taking now, John, is philosophy and communication of cybernetics, or not cybernetics, but cyberspace.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And even though it's dealing some with it, it's really stretching into other aspects, not just dealing with technology today, but really looking at how technology is used worldwide and a lot of the implications of how this mm-hmm. technology is affecting and impacting our daily lives. In fact, mm-hmm. the truth of the matter is it has caused me to look at some things, and my paper for this particular class is going to be on what it means to be human in this cyberspace world that we're living in. Mm-hmm. Have we lost, or are we losing our humanness in light mm-hmm. of the technology that is out there now? One book that I just read, and John, if I could put my hands on it right now and find it, I would read this piece. And guess what? I just turned right to it. I'll read this to you and let you chew on it for a moment. But this, I had to bring this out in a class that I was in, one of my recent classes. This is past Tuesday, in fact. And it says this: if we choose to pry culture away from capitalism while the rest of life is still capitalistic, culture will become a slum. In fact, online culture increasingly resembles a slum in disturbing ways. Slums have more advertising than wealthy neighborhoods, for instance. People are meaner in slums. Mob rule and vigilantism are commonplace. If there is a trace of slumming in the way that many privileged young people embrace current online culture, it is perhaps an echo of 1960s counterculture.
Wow.
And so I found that to be a very, very thought-provoking paragraph.
Yeah, provocative.
That I read.
Mm-hmm. Right. What was the name of the book?
The name of the book is You Are Not a Gadget by Jerron Lanier. And actually, this book was written in 2010, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was written in 2010. And so you would think that it was written just yesterday.
Yeah, yeah, relevant. Yeah, prophetic voice almost, you know, even if it's a secular prophet. Yeah. All right, you mentioned writing a paper. You are a manuscript preacher, is that correct?
Correct.
Talk to us about talk to us about how you came to that technique, because when I first approached this issue, I was very biased against it because I just thought it's going to be dry. It's, you know, you are brilliant at it, you are effective at it, and just talk to our listeners a little bit about why you use that technique and any technique. I don't want to sound like it's mechanical, because it's not, but I'll leave that word there. how you came to that decision to deploy that way of preaching, and what's involved in that, how, you know, during your week, and how you've adapted it to perhaps your own style that in my mind has just made it so effective and turned me totally around where the concept of a manuscript preacher is concerned.
To be honest with you, John, I've never really liked being a manuscript preacher. I just know how I am. And if I do not have a manuscript in front of me, I tend to wander.
Mm-hmm.
It's synonymous with you leaving a point of destination, leaving a point where you are, trying to get to your destination, but not having a roadmap.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that if I try to get to a destination, I have a habit, if I do not have something in front of me, of wandering all over the place until I finally think that I got there.
Mm-hmm.
And so manuscript preaching for me has been a part of me, my whole preaching career. As I said, or as I alluded to, I have manuscripts from my grandfather, my father, my uncle. And so all of them were manuscript preachers. And so I kind of went along with the program there. And so I work towards developing that. I like to be, and since I don't like in particular being a manuscript preacher, I've tried to use the manuscript to be or deliver the manuscript, deliver the sermon in such a way that I'm more conversational than I am reading the manuscript. And so that's why I am a manuscript preacher. I generally have an idea of what I'm going to preach on a given Sunday. By Tuesday of the week, I usually try to let Mondays kind of relax my mind a little bit, and so I I have something in mind that I'm going to preach on Tuesdays of the week. And then I do all of my exegetical work with respect to that on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. I read the passage. I reread the passage. I reread the passage. I reread the passage because I want to immerse myself. I need to immerse myself in the passage before I really do any exegetical work on it. I begin to record my impressions on it so that by Thursday I have a sermon skeleton, i.e. a general outline that I have regarding the text, so that Fridays, generally speaking, I'm writing the manuscript. And then I try to use Saturdays as a time of reflection, try to use Saturdays as a time of rest, and also a time of review, where Saturday evening, I generally try to sit down and just go over the sermon that I have written, make my necessary corrections, make the adjustments that I feel need to be made, and pray over it so that by Sunday morning, and when I'm up early on Sunday mornings anyway, so I do another review of the sermon on Sunday morning, so that when I present it on Sunday at the worship hour, it is generally where I feel the Lord is leading me to preach.
But you're not afraid, or at least, in the times that I've seen you, you will deviate. You have a great sense on when to stop and maybe, you know, take a little side trip or celebrate or whatever the you feel the need of the moment is. So you're not adverse or hesitant to do that, are you?
No, it's what we call getting a text message from heaven. Sometimes in the sermon, there are thoughts that come in from the Holy Spirit, I believe, that really go in with what your sermon is about. And so you take those instant messages, if you will, the IMs, and just put them into the sermon. And usually it's something that the Spirit of the Lord brings back to your remembrance. And I could spend another 3 hours just talking about that, because the Spirit of the Lord cannot bring back to your remembrance what you have not allowed to get in there in the first place, which means that you have to expose yourself to some things. That's why sermons, believe it or not, sermons for me are not created in the study. Sermons for me are created on a drive. Sermons for me are created. I get my best imaginative juices are flowing when I'm outside, just on a walk maybe, or sitting on my balcony, or taking a drive, or running to the store or something. That's when my best imaginative juices really begin to flow. And so you have to be open, and you have to expose yourself to what the Spirit of the Lord says at a specific time and place.
And I guess that's what I've appreciated about you. While I feel you are using the manuscript to create your boundaries and to structure, I've never felt that's all there is. There's a whole lot more than that, and it certainly comes through. And I'm not the only one who thinks that. At least before the pandemic, your preaching schedule, which was always out at a lot of churches, especially for special events where I think people want something that's memorable and refreshing, and you've always produced that. Let me go back to teaching a little bit, and then we've got about 17, 18 minutes. I want to just mention, I saw you on the news earlier this year in the paper. I want to give you a chance to address that. You are a very successful instructor at college level. Why? What's your teaching philosophy? That you may not even think is very special, but obviously is special to the recipients, the students. What allows you to connect so well with the students in your classes?
I would say this, John. Number one, becoming comfortable with who I am. I really feel, first of all, I know that my spiritual gift is teaching. I know that. In fact, I really consider myself a better teacher than I am a preacher, to be honest with you. And so I've always had this propensity of wanting to teach. In fact, when I first started my educational track, I was asked, why am I following through on education? And one of the reasons why I mentioned I was following through on my education was because I wanted to teach on a Bible school / seminary level. So that's always been a part of me. It's always been a part of my thinking. And so I wanted to pursue that, which is the reason why I've always moved towards advanced degrees. But I've always also wanted to stretch those who were my students. In fact, they would tell you that that's one of my key words, stretching. People need to be stretched. One of the things that I do mention is that people need to move in the Church of Christ today. People need to move beyond the Sunday school surface teaching and really dig down deep into what the Word of God really has to say. Too much of what we hear nowadays is infantile. Too much of what we hear nowadays is dealing with the emotions. And believe me, and you know my church, John, you know my context, I have nothing against emotions, but I also think that there needs to be some balance.
Sure.
People should bring their emotions to church, but they should also bring their minds to church.
Mm-hmm.
If at some point during the sermon I have not given people an aha moment, or sometimes during teaching people have not had an aha moment, then I feel as if I've not accomplished that which should have been accomplished. So teaching has really been a part of me. I want to see the body of Christ inspired, but also want to see the body of Christ challenged. I recognize this is an age where we are dealing with biblical illiteracy. In fact, one of the favorite phrases that I use is a term that I heard, or a phrase I heard, some 30, 35 years ago now, that the average Christian is about as equipped to do battle against the atheist or the agnostic as a boy with a pea shooter standing before the fanfare of a machine gun. That shows you the biblical illiteracy that really takes place. And we have been influenced now in this day and age by the prosperity gospel, that we've really lost what the Bible is really saying to us. In fact, I don't mind putting it like this. I think by and large, American Christianity has replaced biblical Christianity. So I want to see, which is the reason why I teach the way I do, I want to see a return to biblical Christianity and not an Americanized Christianity.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely weakened the church and watered down the message, and consequently we don't have, we can't offer people, you know, all the resources and tools that they need to be free. If anything, it burdens them, it weighs them down even more. Well, it's obvious that, you know, you carry out your philosophy, and I've seen it firsthand and heard it firsthand with the students. And again, I'm just so delighted that, you know, you're having a chance to expand that now at Duquesne University. Doc, we've got about 10 minutes left. I did see you in the news earlier this summer. I want to give you a chance to talk about your visit to the mayor's office and make any comments that you want to make of what took you there, or any progress that you think has been made, or issues that are still on your mind. And I know, we, like you said earlier, we could do that for 3 hours. But give us the cliff notes, give us the quick overview, and let us know where you are on that issue.
I'll put it like this, John. I had conversation with several clergy, and we're talking about the George Floyd situation. We're talking about Breonna Taylor. We're talking about Ahmaud Arbery and Philando Castillo. Antoine Rose Jr. and others who have been the victim of police violence. The George Floyd situation really impacted a lot of us. 8 minutes and 46 seconds of watching this police officer put his knee on the neck of George Floyd. Many of us were troubled by that, and many clergy were hurting, and we did come under fire that very day. We held that march of clergy. We did come under fire that day with some of the news media asking why we did not include members of the congregation, why we did not include young people in the march and what have you. We felt it necessary for the clergy to be heard because, number one, clergy were hurting and clergy were angry at what we had witnessed with George Floyd. Clergy continue to be angry by what we have witnessed with Breonna Taylor, with Ahmaud Arbery, and others. And so we felt it necessary to, you know, let our voices be heard. We marched downtown, came under the ire of one driver who felt it necessary to get out of his car and use some unholy language toward us. We did go and meet with Mayor Peduto and some promises were apparently made. In fact, I just got an email about half an hour ago regarding from one of our members regarding some things that we have requested with respect to police reform. We also gave a similar letter, same letter really, to County Executive Fitzgerald, in which we have not heard back from him to date. But there were some issues that we were concerned about that we felt needed to be addressed. So we're continuing our fight to try to make sure that some of these issues are addressed, some of the issues we're dealing with right in our own community of Braddock. We're continuing to struggle because we recognize that one march is not going to get it. One battle is not going to get it. This is an ongoing issue. And if you look at history, this has been an ongoing fight, in particular for African Americans, for decades, yay, even centuries. Mm-hmm. And so we continue to fight. We continue to let our voices be heard, whether it's in the streets or across the pulpits. Again, we go back to where we started off initially. The context influences our preaching. And so what we witness within American society, whether it is the racism that takes place, systemic racism, as we believe that it is, that it's a part of the fabric of American society. It should not be, but it is. All of that influences what we preach because we want to see people free, not just spiritually, but mentally, emotionally, physically. We want to see people free. And so our message that we preach is a message of liberation, that Jesus Christ is a liberator of people. That's why Luke 4:18-19 is so pivotal. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to preach the year of the Lord's favor. That's a part of liberation. And so that influences what we preach. That influences why we march. And that influences why we do the things that we do in our community and abroad. Because we believe also, in the words of Dr. Ron Peters, that the church that does not affect the community that it's in ceases to be the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well put, well said. Again, just a few minutes, but I think, if I remember correctly, some of the things you said to the mayor, it was not a defunding of the police, it was a reprioritization of some of the resources. Is that a fair summary?
That's a fair summary. That's a fair summary. There are issues. Yes, we do need to invest in police training. We do need to, and I am an advocate, John, for a countywide review board, although there are those who are against that. I believe there needs to be a countywide review board on all police activity. That I could go into another diatribe on that. But we're also looking at resources as far as education is concerned, resources as it relates to housing, resources in relation to transportation and recreation. Those are areas where we've really said that resources need to be reallocated. So that you can, and employment for jobs, you know, so that we can become a more livable city as Pittsburgh has been viewed. Even the Post-Gazette and the Tribune Review had mentioned how the fact that Pittsburgh is the most livable city for some, but not necessarily for African Americans.
We continue
to make our voices heard.
Well, good. What you preaching on this Sunday as we close?
I am praying about and have prayed about a particular passage that's found in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 7 and 8. We're troubled on every side, but not perplexed, persecuted, but not destroyed, struck down, but not struck out. I'm paraphrasing right there. But just a word of encouragement for people in this time that we are not forsaken. God has not forsaken us. God has not forgotten about us. I'll use the words of my friend Pastor Barbara Gunn that she just used. We are critical. We're critical, but we are stable.
Yeah.
Critical
condition,
but
stable. Well put. Yeah.
Yes.
Very good. Well, Doc, thank you for your time. God bless you in your studies. God bless you in your ministry. God bless you in your community activity, and it's been great to reconnect with you. And when you're ready to put the next compilation of sermons together, you please let me know.
Well, it's not going to be sermons, the next one. The next one is actually going to be entitled Bouncing Back, Life After Your Decision Making.
Beautiful. And look forward to it if I would be so privileged to work on that. And I also went on and ordered the book that you quoted earlier, the one about the We Are Not Gadgets. I'm looking forward to reading that. Thanks for the tip, and thanks for all you do.
Sure.
God bless, and give my love to your wife.
Will do. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
All righty. Take care. So long.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. There we had Reverend Dr. Richard Wingfield. Gosh, we could have talked for another hour. I really appreciate his work, his ministry. Obviously, I'm a fan and wanted to share him with you. Monday, we are going to have my friend Doreen Upshaw on, who has written the book, My Life with Amos, that I had an opportunity to, I had a hand in editing, but she's involved in community counseling, and so we want to have a chance chance to hear from her, another outstanding African American in our community. Well, this is John Stanko, your host for Wake Up to Purpose, and that's all there is for today, but there'll be more next week. Until we're together again, you be about the work of purpose in your life. So long for now.
Thanks again for listening to Wake Up to Purpose with John Stanko. To get in touch with John, you can go to www.purposequest.com or write him at johnstanko@gmail.com.